The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in tonight. Great show, as always, planned. And first, we'll do a couple of announcements and get everybody prepped for our program. So for those of you that would like to call us, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we're not using call screeners. Please let the phone ring, be patient, and we will bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I will answer the phone over the break and put you on hold, so don't let the upcoming break stop you from making that phone call. And if your call is relevant, I'll be happy to hold you over the break as well. So again, it is 1-866-687-7223. If you prefer using email, it is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And that is our website, thespaceshow.com. So if you do go there, you will see a very detailed newsletter in the middle of the page. And this is our website newsletter. So it has all of the information in detail about the programs for the coming week, the guest bios, and it's the only place where we have a future events section for the Space Show. That is what's coming up on the program in the near future. It is also the only place where we change the schedule of the Space Show. So if a guest has to change the schedule, or if I do for one reason or another, or equipment breaks or something, we post that change on the website newsletter. So if you tune in a program and you expect to hear guest A and you hear dead air, or you hear guest D, then before you start wondering what happened and firing off emails, go to the website newsletter. I bet we've already explained what happened and when guest A will reschedule to be a guest on the program. Also on the newsletter, website newsletter and on the homepage, all of our archives are there, so you can listen to all of our programs. They're an easy download if you want to download them, or you can listen to them right off of our website. All 2,500 and I think we're coming up on 2,550. They're all there except for two of them. And they're easy to download. If you have a high-speed internet connection, it's maybe a minute and a half. And we encourage you to download them, to share them with other people, or to pass the URL around if you don't want to pass the files around, or just listen off of our website or our blog. Our blog is thespaceshow.wordpress.com. Also on our website is a store up near the top, Space Show Gear. Check it out. Lots of interesting items there. And then, to me, always the most important button is support the Space Show, because that's what keeps us going. We are a 501c3 nonprofit with one giantleapfoundation.org. And remember, if you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a deduction for your gift. And if you're a California taxpayer, you are also going to get a deduction for your gift. Not so sure about foreigners. And I'm not so sure about other states, so please check with your own people about that. And as you know, we've been pushing our Indiegogo crowdfunding program, which does qualify for a tax deduction. It is a nonprofit crowdfunding program to modernize our website and our archive database. Our campaign ends in 5 hours, and it's been a long 30 days, and I'm proud to say that 134 of you have supported us, and we appreciate that more than you can imagine. We have gone about $1,600 over our goal, and we're very pleased that will help us do some additional things with our website modernization plan. And there are still some pretty cool perks left that are only available when we have an Indiegogo campaign like this, and I don't really see another one coming around for a long, long time. So you might still want to use these 5 hours, if you haven't done it yet, to check it out and see if something is there of interest for you. These opportunities are still there. And as I said, they disappear as soon as the campaign goes away. You know, like listener voices, read about that, hosting your own show, co-hosting, being a space show sponsor at an unbelievable price. It's all right there, 5 hours left, and we thank all of you who have made this happen on our project, and you'll be hearing more about our progress as we continue on down the line. We're shooting for the end of November to launch the new website. We are trademarked and copyrighted, and we do encourage you to download our shows and share them, or at least share the URL with people. There are a couple of rules about that. So one of them is don't do anything commercial with our programs. The big, big rule is don't edit and cut and clip things out of our shows and then go upload them to a YouTube channel or anything else, including your own website. And then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And we have a full, detailed copyright statement at the bottom of every Space Show website page, and the same for OneGiantLeapFoundation.org's website pages. So check it out, and if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we are podcasting through gigadial.net, and the RSS URL is on our website and our newsletters, both the website newsletter and the very short email newsletter we send out early Monday morning, 6 a.m. California time. So if you have any questions or you want to receive that newsletter, please send me your information. And podcasting, well, we're in iTunes and a host of other places. If you have any questions about podcasts, even if they're on your smartphone, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. Again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Right now we have two sponsors, but that's going to expand significantly once our campaign ends. But the Secure World Foundation has been a sponsor with us for a long, long time, and they help promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can pick up a lot more information about them off of their own website. They also partially sponsor our webinar series, their website, swfound.org. Tom Driggers is our life-saving broadcast engineer and website creative savior of all saviors. And he's been with us for 13 out of the 14 years we've been in existence. And he has kept us going during some really dark spots where the 11th, 12th, and 13th hour help was needed. And we haven't had downtime with him. So he's a remarkable guy. So if you need those kinds of services, engineering, emergency website services, other things like that, Tom's your guy, and his information is on our sponsors page on both thespaceshow.com and OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. So make sure you check that out. More about our new sponsors later, but that's not for tonight. I'm very happy to, first of all, I got to meet this guest in person, so that makes me very, very happy. I don't get to meet most of the Space Show guests, but Jason was at the New Space Conference in July in Silicon Valley, and I got to meet him and talk to him in person, and that makes my day when I get to meet Space Show guests in person. And Jason Reimmuller is back with us, and his project, for those of you that have listened to many, many Space Show programs, he was on the show not too long ago about Project Possum, which is spelled a unique way, so you can check it out in how I wrote it, P-O-S-S-U-M. And this is a polar suborbital science project in the upper mesosphere. And their website, if you want to follow along with us, is Project Possum, all one word, .org. And Jason is a scientist, and he's been with the Space Science Institute and president of the Integrated Spaceflight Services, serving as PI for the Project Possum, which, as I said, is polar suborbital science in the upper mesosphere campaign to study polar mesosphere and non-telucent, always get this wrong, clouds, structuring using manned reusable launch vehicles. He's a leading person in the development of spacecraft egress training modules, training simulators, and analog space training capabilities. His bio is on the website already. He has a PhD in aerospace engineering sciences from the University of Colorado in Boulder, where he is this evening. He has his MS degree in physics from San Francisco State University, just across the bridge from me. And boy, he's been around. MS degree in aviation systems from the University of Tennessee, and another MS degree in aerospace engineering from the University of Colorado, and his BS in aerospace engineering from the Florida Institute of Technology. Have we left out any schools, Jason?
Oh, I think you covered it. Thank you very much, David.
Welcome back to the show. It was a pleasure to meet you in San Jose or Silicon Valley, I guess, and a greater pleasure to talk to you again on the space show. What's new with Project Possum? What have you been doing the past 3 years since we talked to you?
Oh, indeed, David. Thank you for having me this evening. Just want to go back to one of the comments you said. Actually, it's not a unique spelling of possum. They're actually two completely different animals. There's possum, as it's spelled, as our acronym, which is an Australian marsupial, and then the possum that starts with a letter O, that's a North American marsupial. So, you know, in the interest of global representation, we found a good acronym that represented our friends in Australia.
So you're representing the Australian marsupial.
Indeed.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that from before. So the critter on your logo, that's the Australian guy?
It is an Australian marsupial, but I believe he's still representing the U.S. flag on a spacesuit. So
yeah, he's got
it's an international program.
He doesn't look like he's very happy, though. He looks like he's a mean guy.
Well, I've had a number of different comments on his expression and his looks, but whimsical usually is the first one that comes to people's lips.
Looks like his spacesuit might be a little bit too tight on him.
Perhaps.
What's new over the past couple of years with your project?
Great. Well, we've come a long way since we had the opportunity to talk a couple years ago. So a brief update on Possum. So like you, were a 501c3. Our research and education program, and we focus on the study of the NLT region. This is the mesosphere, upper mesosphere region. And we have a unique turn on engaging the general public through citizen science, as well as educational outreach, to try to educate people really about what we do as scientists in the mesosphere. And so the program really came about 4 years ago. We started actually with a NASA-supported flight opportunity, and that was granted in March of 2012. The proposal really came from an extension of my own dissertation, where I looked at noctilucent clouds, which are the highest clouds in our atmosphere, and they stratify near the mesopause, which is about 83 kilometers high. And the clouds are of particular interest to a number of communities, specifically the global climate community. There's many that see these clouds as being indicative of global climate trends, global climate change. And they're also of interest to reentry vehicles and engineers, especially of manned vehicles. The space shuttle has never intentionally reentered through a cloud simply because we don't know enough about this region. And it's also a really good analog environment to study, to do comparative planetology to low-density atmospheres on other planets. But it's also one of the areas of our planet that we know the least, and we've never really had a presence there. So the program really sees an incredible opportunity to study this area in ways that have never before been available. So we see the opportunity with these new commercial vehicles to be able to do science, really unprecedented science, and to be able to model the mesosphere in ways that can address some key questions that the aeronomy community, aeronomy being the study of the upper atmosphere, has been dealing with for a while. For example, how are energy and momentum transferred and deposited in the upper atmosphere, and how do the solar influence interact with the terrestrial influences? These are questions that we don't really know because we've never really been able to get much in situ data of the mesosphere, but we see the capabilities that are coming online, and we see that we are going to be able very soon to be able to get the data that we need to build the models to address these questions.
Are you launch vehicle agnostic, or do you have a specific agenda for a vehicle, or have you already committed to a vehicle?
Well, the program is broad, and we have two principal experiments. One we call the Noctilucent Cloud Imagery Experiment, and one we call the Noctilucent Cloud Tomography Experiment. What we're looking at both are the small-scale structures, and these are the structures that we think the majority of the energy can be seen. So we want to focus in on specific instabilities, things like Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities and different things that can show shear or anything that can refine the picture. It's like, you know, our models of the universe, where we believe most of the data is within this dark matter. That's 90%, you know, very similar to this upper atmosphere where we can see these clouds, and these clouds are the biggest, best observable of the dynamics of the upper atmosphere. The upper atmosphere is the most sensitive part of our environment. So the more we understand this area, we can see how small changes in our global ecology can reflect themselves very broadly through these observables. So going back to the launch vehicles, the imagery experiment relies on balloons, and we are looking initially next year, planning hopefully a balloon launch in the season. We have a tight schedule to make. The observation season is in July, and we will be looking at these small-scale structures from altitudes of about 35 kilometers. And the tomography experiment, and this is what we base a lot of our education and outreach programs are, it's a very exciting program. We're going to use a reusable suborbital launch vehicle to actually build tomography of these clouds and these small-scale structures, much like an MRI would go around a person and create a 3D representation of a human body. Be very similar to how we would use a suborbital launch vehicle to get a wide variety of scattering angles from these structures to be able to recreate these features in three dimensions.
Are the clouds always present, or do you have to find a time when they're present?
Well, they're tricky. They're very elusive. They form only in a particular season from about a little bit before, maybe 15 to 20 days before the summer solstice, and they expand maybe 40 to 50 days after the solstice. And any other time, the atmosphere is too warm. It's a little counterintuitive that the coldest time of the year is actually right in the middle of the summer. It's an interesting phenomenon, the upper atmosphere. So there's only a small window. There's no really real way you can predict on any given night when a cloud is going to form. So you go to the field, you wait, and when you see one, you launch, or you go get it. And I've had experience on this through my own dissertation with a flight campaign. You go during the season, and we were up there many nights just waiting for them to come, and then you see them, and you run in pre-flight and take off and get up and image them. So it's really one of these things you have to just be ready, and when you see them...
So you can see them from the ground?
Yes.
And then you pretty much have launch on demand?
Yes, and certainly some of these vehicles are very exciting. One of the companies we've worked closest with has been X-Corp. They're looking at a capability of ultimately being able to conduct suborbital flights every 2 hours. So this is very exciting potential. Within a formation of an Noctilucent cloud, you could, you know, feasibly have up to four sorties, like four sets of data.
Do these only form over the poles, or could you be launching someplace else down the road and get to them as well?
They really only form in the polar regions. From the ground, you can just see them in a band of maybe 8 to 10 degrees of latitude. Too far north, you have too much sunlight. So if you are perhaps somewhere between Edmonton and maybe even up to Fairbanks latitude, between that 55 and 65, you may notice in the season when the sun is set, at least maybe 6 degrees below the horizon and up to maybe 12 or even 14 degrees below, when most of the air below these clouds, below this 83-kilometer altitude, is in the shadow, but yet the clouds can still reflect direct sunlight. So it's all in the signal-to-noise ratio. When the sun is below the horizon like that, you can see these from the ground. Now, from space, when you're over 30 kilometers, you really don't have that background noise. So the clouds will get denser the closer you go to the pole. So the farther north or the farther poleward you can go, the more dense the clouds should be.
What about the South Pole? Do you have the same thing going on down there?
Exactly. And we think that there's actually a coupling of the occurrence of the clouds. Of course, in the South Pole, the summer will go from, you know, the observation season will go from about mid-December to early February.
So you're basically launch vehicle agnostic, but there's only a couple of vehicles out there that probably meet your needs once they start flying. Is that correct?
Yes. Now, we've worked the closest with X-Core Aerospace. Certainly, Blue Origin has a very capable vehicle, and Swiss Space Systems is also developing a very capable vehicle as well.
I don't know as much about the Swiss Space vehicle. They're coming along okay. I have yet to do a show with them. So
they're not as mature as X-Core or Blue Origin.
When I was at your booth at New Space, it looked like you were also running training programs of a sort, correct?
Indeed. So,
talk about that, because that's different than what we talked about before.
Okay. So, two of the issues that we as astronomers, with the astronomy community, do not do well enough, or the community is in need of, one is education and public outreach. Most people have never heard the word mesosphere or noctilucent clouds or astronomy for that matter. In fact, they joke about that and say they call the mesosphere the ignorosphere. I think that's something that we are failing as a community to do. And the other opportunity is there's such a scarcity of public funds available for research, but yet there's this great opportunity, and people are excited about the opportunities of personal spaceflight. We also find that most of these people, they don't want to go as tourists. They don't want to be baggage. They don't want to spend $250,000 to go sit behind Justin Bieber. So what we are seeing the opportunity is that, you know, these people that grow up in the Apollo program and into the shuttle program, these are scientists and engineers. These are people that have this passion in spaceflight, and they want to do something. They want to contribute. They want to enable science. They want to communicate science. They want to be part of the team. And that's really what where Project Possum comes in, is that we found from when we started the program that it generated a lot of excitement because it was, from the start, a manned research program. And there's been nothing really like that. There's never really been a manned suborbital research program that really does science. So the suborbital programs have been technology demonstrators, such in the case of MR3 and MR4 and Soyuz accident, and certainly technology demonstration with the Spaceship One. But really designing a research program that requires careful coordination between a scientist and a pilot, this is a novel program in that way. And it's not something that can really be automated well. And these clouds are very elusive. You can't even see from the ground what you're going to study. So with some new balloon data that we have, we see that these structures do form quite well. And we need to train people to be able to identify exactly what's going to be the most scientifically valuable on each mission, so that they can quickly recognize these features and then be able to zoom in on the features with the imagers, to prioritize the different payloads that are all controlled through a center interface we call Possum Cam, and to do this in close coordination with the pilot. So communication skills between scientist and pilot as well as real-time identification of the clouds and execution of the different payloads in different steps. So a typical mission, for example, you would wait until you see a strong enough cloud feature. The simulator we've designed in partnership with the Embry-Riddle University will is designed roughly on a two-seat vehicle like the Lynx. It would take off. You'll have your main engine cut off at about stratopause altitude. At this time, your scientist is able to identify features that they'll want to track. We'll have a pitch-down maneuver. The scientists will deploy a probe on one of our two external payloads. This will look at pressures. You don't want to deploy the probe before your main engine cutoff. Then you're ascending rapidly towards the cloud. This time you've identified features you want to track. You're building tomography. You have a feedback on your main imager. You have a wide-field imager that's capturing at a quick hertz rate the broad structure of the entire cloud. You have an infrared camera that's looking at the coupling, the vertical coupling, within the airglow. And then the video camera is the one that we zoom in on these microfeatures. So the scientist, the operator, will be able to control the iris and the zoom of this camera and get feedback from this and do minor corrections directly or be able to do through effective crew resource management, direct the pointing and the attitude of the vehicle with the pilot. So all the scientist is doing this, the probe extends. It's also getting neutrals and charged particle densities. And then once it penetrates the cloud, which you don't exactly know the altitude, we know it's approximate altitude, we'll get a sample. And there's a manual switch that'll grab the sample. The vehicle will hit apogee and then descend. There's a second sample that's obtained, and then the probe will be retracted before the vehicle's configured for reentry. So all this happens within 3 to 4 minutes, and you don't even know what you're going to look at until you're up there. So it's a mission that will take a lot of coordination between the two. But what we do in the program that we offer at Embry-Riddle is that we train people initially, but the main focus is teaching them about the science, teaching them about the program so they can communicate the science. They communicate the science, they communicate the program, and it helps expand what we as the astronomy community do and what the significance of noctilucent clouds are.
So they're not necessarily being trained to do an actual mission. They're being they're going to school, so to speak, to understand and be able to talk about the science.
They're trained nominally to do a mission in all of our courses. So the courses will train people in spacesuit operations, off-nominal environments. They know how to use the spacesuit, recognize personal signs of hypoxia, the basic mobility in the suits. They work with the simulation through different steps. And then we have a whole simulation facility that we built in partnership with Embry-Riddle. And we have a suborbital spaceflight simulator there. It's some great wraparound visuals, and the Possum Can instrument is mounted there for the scientist. You know, we designed this to be operated in a real spacesuit. As we do this, we bring back good design data for not only the Possum Can instruments, but our partners, Final Frontier Designs, that we work with spacesuits. So a lot of these data help them mature their product as well. As with a lot of our partners. The simulator itself, the clouds, through partnership with Sundog Software in Orlando, done a wonderful job creating a mesosphere model. And this model itself creates these clouds from fundamental principles of the mesosphere. So it's not projecting an image or something. It's actually creating these so that just through randomization, you can, these microfeatures and these large-scale bands and billows and the microfeatures appear all in real time and all randomized. it's a fantastic model that they've done. And Vasco Ribeira, one of our partners in Brazil, has made a wonderful vehicle, captures a lot of the dynamics and you know, behaves very much like we'd expect suborbital vehicle like that to behave. And all of this is put in a simulation room. We have a spacesuit don-and-doff facility and a pressurization facility so that you pressurize and train the spacesuit and then go right into the room. There's a mission control complex that simulates the communication links between the mission control center and the pilot. And then when you hit your main engine cutoff, you work on the communication between the scientist and the pilot. So it's really it's a facility that we try to make as realistic as possible, certainly for Possum, but then there's a lot of spin-off research that we've been working with Embry-Riddle as well to be able to do.
Your first email question of the night comes from Ted, who's in Houston, Texas. And Ted says, what does it cost to go through the program at Embry-Riddle that you're talking about, and how do you assure you get to participate in a real mission?
Okay, that's a really good question. Now, the program, we try to really boil the program down to science and instrumentation. You know, we don't put many bells and whistles. You know, we don't have really snazzy, expensive fighter jets or whatever have you. We focus on science and instrumentation in the best simulated environment of the flight as possible. We have two programs. They're similar. We have one program called the Possum Scientist Astronaut Program, Qualification Program, and we have a second program called Possum Academy. The experience of going through both is similar. The Scientist Astronaut Program, we work with Hattie Wagstaff, legendary aviator, to recreate as much of the physical strains of a flight as possible. And we get some biometric harness feedback. We train people to use anti-G garments and other methods of mitigating high G forces and simulate the transitions of Gs from high Gs to microgravity. We do the spacesuit work. We do the simulation. We do epoxy awareness in a probably the best civil facility in the U.S. We actually are able to simulate slow-onset hypoxia while doing Possum missions or any other missions within the chamber. That's a really exciting capability there. And so all this is designed to, as cost-effectively as possible, get the most benefit in terms of aeronomy education and real applicable training that would go towards mission. Now, the program itself has no guarantee of a flight opportunity. But we work with all of our graduates, and we have monthly meetings that follow and try to work with them to gain sponsorships and other means to fund the flight opportunities. It's a 501c3. That helps a lot. It's easier to go out and engage potential sponsors for individual flight opportunities. So a deployment to study the clouds when you actually deploy to a location. You want to get as many flights as possible, get as much data as possible so that we can ultimately build our mesospheric models from this. So, you know, certainly in our best interest to make sure as many of our graduates will get the opportunity to fly as possible.
What does it cost? Can you tell Ted what
yes.
it costs?
So we, the base cost, we've had a recent promotion into this. It's a $5,000 for the week-long program. And the Possum Academy was $4,000, and we just had a promotion to $3,500 on that. And I'm going to extend that to any of your listeners to see if they reference the space show. I think we have maybe two slots in Possum Academy for this October, the 6th through the 10th.
Now, if they want to actually do a mission, which of these programs should they take?
Well, the difference between these two is that the Possum Scientist Astronaut Program assumes a STEM bachelor's level education. It assumes basically the mathematics knowledge through some calculus, preferably differential equations. So the idea is we not only express things in the class, but we assume that the graduates will be able to stay current in the field through the publications that come out. We share an update on the state of the art in mesosphere research. Whereas the Possum Academy program assumes only up to a trigonometry level of education. So we focus a little more on the academics. We teach it more conceptual. There is only one high G flight instead of two, and it's a lower cost.
So your path to actually doing a mission is the science astronaut path.
Yes, but the Possum Academy program, as well as we work with people through both programs, and that as presumably Academy program is interested in STEM field is on a course. Most of the people that are in the program have come as either seniors in high school or undergraduates, and then upon graduation, review the academics and then stand behind them as a or scientist astronaut candidates.
Do they go year round, or is there a season for the classes?
This current class is in October. The following one is planned for the week. Both the scientist astronaut program and academy are planned for mid to late May in 2016.
So then you're only doing basically two a year?
We're doing two a year for the scientist astronaut program, and the Possum Academy, we're in the process of growing to a program that will actually be able to take to high schools in different regions and be able to do direct education outreach for that matter.
Now, obviously, you take high school students because you just mentioned that. Is there an upper end age limit or something that would fare out senior citizens, for example?
Class 3 medical, an FAA Class 3 medical. This is required for some of the chamber work. It's recommended for the high G work.
So that would be both the academy and the astronaut class?
Now, the academy, we go on, down to 16, but the chamber flights, we wouldn't be able to do the hypoxia training.
Okay, so class 3 medical for that.
Yes.
Well, that's actually pretty easy to pass.
So basically, the academy, we go through, it's academic heavy. We cover atmospheric science and the mesosphere, global climate principles, noctilucent cloud science. Conceptually, we get into atmospheric scattering, how to observe these clouds, what goes behind designing a custom mission for Aronomy research. We go into the instrumentation, a little bit about the cinematography and the different things you need to consider to get good science imagery from science imagery instrumentation. We go through simulation. We cover things like spaceflight physiology, as well as the physiological effects of spaceflight, effects of hypoxia, as well as spaceflight support systems, and then just get into a little bit about what goes into the design and operation of spacesuits and design of specific missions as well. So it's a pretty broad but very hands-on program.
Carl is in Philadelphia, and he says, when do you expect your first flights to take place? And in addition to that, do you foresee any problems in people that have back problems or take prescription drugs getting into your program?
Okay, fair question. Now, we can't commit to a particular flight until vehicles are actually flying. Now, our constraint is that we're flying in the Northern Hemisphere, and the peak season for us would be late July. So we'll fly late July of some year. Now, we, in our workings with X-Corps, our target date is July 2017. If that's not the case, we're going to basically be ready to deploy and fly at following July. And we're also working right now with FAA and the Air Force concerning logistics, licensing for a spaceport. There are several options that we're looking at presently. So there's a few logistical details that are still in the making for this. But the concerning the question about
medical
physical
condition.
Again, that comes back to the Class 3 physical. I'm not sure if that's going to be different with any of these vehicles. It's really going to be the decision of the vehicle operator what the medical requirements are going to be for a member. Just a Class 3 physical is required for the programs that we offer at Embry-Riddle.
I haven't heard you mention Virgin. Are they under consideration at all?
Certainly. No, we have talked to Virgin. The vehicle certainly is very capable of obtaining those altitudes. The vehicle is transportable, and you know, certainly something we want to maintain the dialogue. It's a bigger vehicle. It's you know, the cost per flight is significantly more. This particular mission has both temporal and spatial constraints, so you have to be somewhere, and you pretty much have to dedicate the flight profile to the mission. So with Virgin, you need basically six people that are, you know, all a part of the mission, or some of these other vehicles are fewer. It's a little more flexible. But certainly Virgin brings a very capable mission to do, a very capable vehicle to do science as well.
So you wouldn't have this as one of two or three missions on a Virgin vehicle. You'd be taking over the entire vehicle, so to speak.
Not necessarily. You know, the instrumentation, as long as you have a good view, either externally or internally with your camera systems, that's all that's required. The rest of the vehicle can be dedicated to other payloads. Now, how we've designed Possum, at least initially, is we had the initial proposal that was sent and selected by NASA was a proposal for two visual imagers, a wide-field camera and a video camera. From this, we realized that here we have a vehicle that has much broader capability. And we looked at the Lynx Mark II in particular. We wanted to see, with this capability, how can we get as much relevant data that we could specifically address, boil down to one specific science question. And so we did what we call an inverse science traceability matrix. We said, okay, here's our capability. What kind of payloads are out there, or what kind of instrumentation capability is there, and how does this empower, how does this enable addressing the most germane questions of that? So from that, we had a series of different payloads we looked at, and we wanted to see what could configure itself within the cockpit space of Lynx, plus the two external pods that are available. There's two, we call them coffee cans, and I think they're changed to about 2U payloads now. And so we essentially turned that vehicle, conceptually, into an aeronomy laboratory. So in addition to wide-field visible imagery, plus video, high-resolution video cameras, we had infrared imagery, but we also introduced the capability to map the temperature distributions, as well as the neutral and charged particle densities and atmospheric samples from which nitric oxide concentrations can be calculated. And all these data go into the models through our partner at GATS here in Boulder as well, and to develop and mature models of the mesosphere. So that is kind of the process that we looked at with the vehicle. Certainly that process can be repeated based upon the capabilities of other launch vehicles, other spacecraft.
Okay, Jason, we're at the halfway point, so that's a good place to take our break. Listeners, we're going to go ahead and pause for our 3-minute break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your emails and hopefully some of your phone calls. It is 1-866-687-7223 for the toll-free number. Back, everybody, 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. It is the second part of our Tuesday Space Show program. We're talking about Project Possum. Jason, during the break, I mentioned that you're launch vehicle dependent. So how do you spend your time waiting for this launch vehicle to come to the scene and be ready to go? And you talked a lot more about your education and outreach. So why don't you tell us a little more about that?
Certainly. Thank you. The launch vehicle itself, the RSLVs, support one research effort that we do with Possum, and that's the tomography experiment. It's certainly one that's inspiring and exciting people. We're certainly not sitting around waiting for these vehicles to be done. In the last year, we've been developing some payloads, not only the payloads that would support this, but for the balloon experiments. So it's a kind of a crawl, walk, run from a short duration balloon mission to study the clouds to a longer term mission as well, and then leading to the tomography experiments. But the programs that we do, the Scientist Astronaut Program and the Academy, at the core, it's a way of inspiring people and educating people about what we do as astronomers. So get people to know a little bit about this, maybe even inspire the youth to grow up and say, I want to be an astronomer when I grow up, you know, like what Indiana Jones did to archaeology. Really start to introduce the human element to that. And that's what makes this program very unique, the human stories and the human element that goes to the citizen science component of these missions, of the science. And we found in our first program we did in February, we were covered by National Geographic, and a lot of the interest was the diversity of people. We had a cosmonaut Ronnie Nader, for example, representing Ecuador, this country. We had diversity of backgrounds in this, but all people that have interest in or are professionals in different aspects of different STEM fields. So we see now with the programs that are coming next month at Embry-Riddle, we have people coming from all six continents. And so people have different reasons for coming, everyone from educators, engineers, scientists, medical professionals, people from countries like, Egypt and Spain and Portugal and New Zealand and Australia. It's a wide diversity of people representing a wide diversity of interests and backgrounds. And that puts the human story to this, which multiplies the capability to reach out to sponsorship, reach out to media, stories, PR. Each of these human stories, you tell the science and you communicate the science. So that's a lot more interesting to the general public about how this person's representing their country or the background of this other person and how they see and how they tell the science relative to their own personal experiences. So that is what we see as the great possibility of this Possum project relative to previous experiments with balloons and sounding rockets. However, as a science program, we want to make sure that we're always addressing the questions at the proper time. So even though we may need an RFLV to do the tomography experiment, we certainly aren't holding back doing any of our objectives with balloons and imagery.
I have a kind of a strange question for you. This is Ronnie in Las Vegas, and Ronnie said, I have been listening to the program tonight, and I kept thinking you were saying astronomer, but I don't think that's what you're saying. What are you calling the profession that you're talking about?
Exactly, and that's what we fail to do as a community of upper atmospheric scientists. The term is aeronomer, A-E-R-O-N-O-M-Y, aeronomy. And that is the study of the upper atmosphere, the mesosphere, the MLT, the lower thermosphere region. Anything above the stratosphere is typically differentiated in that way. And the difference between what we call atmospheric science, which is generally the troposphere and the stratosphere, and aeronomy, which is our regions where the electrodynamic effects, ionization, play a much, much greater role, is what's different. You know, more rarefied gases as well there. So that's generally how the two sciences are differentiated.
Linda in Seattle says, earlier in the show, you talked about the need to better understand how energy and momentum are transported in and around and from the upper atmosphere. Why do we care about that? I've not studied that, so I don't really know the significance or importance of that.
No, that's a very good question. This is the most sensitive part of our environment. It's really an area where very small changes in concentrations can reflect themselves broadly throughout the globe. So let me address this question from two different ways. The science question is, this is the big interface between the sun and the earth. And this is the beach where the waves coming up from the earth break, and where the energy and particles coming down from the sun get absorbed, photodisassociate. It's all this foam that connects our sun with our earth. So it's really kind of a big deal. That's an important area of our planet, and certainly an area we should know more. Now, the question from the other angle is going back to the who cares test. So we talked initially about the interests. One of the greatest interests is global climate. We have observed these noctilucent clouds, which are the biggest observable in the mesosphere. Now, certainly there's layered phenomena of all sorts, different metallic layers. There's interesting electrical phenomena like sprites and blue jets, and people devote careers to studying these different phenomena. The noctilucent clouds are the main thing we can see from the ground, and these cover mesoscale phenomena, huge swaths of area. Now, why does the global climate community care about noctilucent clouds? Well, we've been seeing these clouds especially the past 40 years, and they're growing in intensity. They're coming to lower latitudes. The seasons are expanding. We're seeing more of them. They're coming with more albedo, more intensity. They're getting stronger. So we ask why. Why do we see this overall trend? You know, there's fluctuations. There's fluctuations with the solar cycle, year to year a little bit. But there's a definite trend that we're seeing a lot more of these clouds are getting stronger, and they're coming to lower latitudes. Why? We know that clouds need two things. They need a low temperature relative to the dew point, and they need water vapor. Well, the two major contributors to the man-made causes of global climate are carbon dioxide and methane. And CO2 acts as a net radiator. It acts as a cooling agent in the upper atmosphere. Methane photodisassociates, and its main product is water vapor. So somehow a combination of these, one maybe more than the other, and this is still a big discussion within the community, But somehow between those that we're creating environment, most probably by man-made forcing of these gases, and that's why we're seeing these clouds more and more. So do noctilucent clouds in themselves affect our environment? Not as much, but the clouds may be very indicative of the trends that we're setting and how we're changing our global environment, specifically through CO2 and methane. And this is something that when we think of global climate, you know, we think of a polar bear on an iceberg, or we think of some other effect of a warming climate, but we don't really think about the atmosphere. And the atmosphere really is what we affect directly. This is what we change through what we emit mostly, and the changes in the atmosphere then reflect themselves in changes in the sea, in the ice, in our forests, deserts, everything that we think of as effects of global warming.
Do rockets, when they go through this part of the atmosphere, do anything to impact one way or another this part of the atmosphere?
Not in major ways, but they do reflect themselves. Certainly the space shuttle has had a number of observations because their fuel and oxidizer is the main product of that is water vapor. So when the shuttle goes through conditions such as in the mesosphere, it'll usually make an artificial cloud. It'll actually form an artificial layer that you can see, and it'll sublimate shortly after the shuttle leaves. But do they necessarily? I don't know if we have that launch number now, but that's certainly an area of concern. That as more and more vehicles go through this more sensitive area of our planet, that there will be more changes directly attributable to the presence of those vehicles.
Randy's in Evanston, Illinois, with an email. And listeners, it is evening time, so let me put out the phone number again instead of all of you guys using email. 1-866-687-7223. So Randy is in Evanston, Illinois, and he says, is there any chance that you would use the JP Aerospace balloons, or what are you using for balloons for your experiments?
So I confess I'm not familiar with JP Aerospace. I will take a note here to research those, and thank you for the contact. We've been working with balloons directly with NASA, Columbia Laboratory, as well as with Worldview Enterprises. They're a newcomer into commercial balloon that have a existing capability and also a very promising plan to go forward, not just for science. Their Voyager concept is something that they're moving very aggressively to, and that is also a manned upper atmosphere platform. So right now those are the two that the program has looked for, and certainly we welcome other capabilities and newcomers. And so if there's a capability that you think, or a payload, or a specific investigation or experiment that you think would fit the POSSUM manifest, the POSSUM program vision well, certainly please write the program. You can write to me directly on the website, projectpossum.org. We'd love to hear from you and see how we can work those particular interests into the program.
JP Aerospace is an all-volunteer balloon company. It's been around for a long, long time, and John Powell in Sacramento runs it, and they do NASA experiments. They do commercials for TV companies and other electronics companies around the world, high-altitude commercials. And he claims he's building what he calls airship to orbit. So this is not the show to go into whether the physics of that makes sense or it's nonsense. I'll let the listeners decide. But he has launched some pretty high-up balloons, and he does things, even though he's a 501c3, he does things commercially, you know, within the realm of what he's doing, and it's all volunteer labor, and they're out of Sacramento, and they do these pong balls or whatever they're called for students all around the world. So that's who JP Aerospace is that Randy was talking about.
Excellent. Well, Randy, thank you for the contact, and please feel free to reach out via email.
So I'm assuming that you can do balloon flights a lot quicker than you can anything to do with propulsion.
Certainly, but they're different objectives for different science. You know, we see these mesosphere itself. There's a lot of different ways. It's remote sensing mostly, and how each capability brings a unique and different way, and often you need to synthesize the capabilities, wide capabilities, to really try to address some of the major questions of this region. For example, my own dissertation, I took a flight research background and flew a small plane in a way that would synchronize flights in North Canada with the AIM satellite. And this AIM, Aeronomy of Ice in the Mesosphere, was the first satellite with a primary mission to study Noctilucent clouds. It's in a sun-synchronous orbit, and a fantastic mission, incredibly successful. It's still operating even now. It was launched in 2005 with a two-year mission. It was extended for a one-year extension to 2008, and it just keeps going, and we still get data from it. In fact, it's permutated so far now that we're actually starting to come back to a point where we can get better and better data. It's even getting better with age, like a fine wine. So it's a good mission. And my point on that was the tying together a ground imager with an aircraft and a satellite in that way allowed us to look at the low latitude thresholds, the most sensitive part of these clouds, and to use those data to refine the processing algorithms of major payload in the satellite. So these balloons and RSLVs and POSSUM are other ways now of addressing science. And we look to tie these data, balloon data, also together with satellite data and ground-based data that can put these in context of major structures, major bands and bellows and these large-scale features of the clouds together with the small-scale features that the balloons could get. And the balloons have the capability of staying at altitude for many hours, if not days or weeks. And this can really look at questions pertaining to the temporal evolution of these structures and the a lot of the questions around that. But the tomography can be enabled by these RSLVs. And so it's a whole different way. And again, the tomography experiment can be backed up by ground imagery as well.
Can you make use of CubeSats in anything that you're doing?
Potentially. the AIM data is there. You know, certainly with any, it depends on the payload, and it's not something we've looked into augmenting these existing missions with a dedicated CubeSat mission. So I'm going to have to say potentially, but we haven't gone there yet.
Carolyn is in San Diego. Are you at the point where you have internship programs?
Hi, Carolyn. we've had some locally, and we work with a couple of our university partners with that. At Embry-Riddle, some of the interns are working, maturing the simulator, our instrumentation as well here in the Boulder region. There's always opportunities. You know, with good skills and passion, we try our best to fit everyone in and get them involved with the program. So if it's something you're interested in, again, please feel free to reach out.
So you'd be open just depending on what the circumstances were?
Yes.
How did you come up with this idea? You said it's based on your dissertation. I've not read it, but how did you come up with this idea to do this research? Did you find something that needed to be done and then try to satisfy the need, or which is sort of the classic way people do things. How did you stumble into this?
Well, I'm sure that dissertation wasn't a bestseller, so
they usually aren't, are they?
So it originated from that, and I think that the real genesis of this was a conference we've been very involved with, the community. It's every 2 years, called LPMR. This is a really geeky name. It's called Layered Phenomena in the Mesopause Region. We just had it last month here in Boulder, Colorado, actually, and it'll be in Germany in 2 years. And it's a main conference for people that deal with noctilucent clouds and other layered phenomena. So in 2011, we got together with Dave Fritz and Gary Thomas and discussed these capabilities. Like, you know, here we have really interesting capabilities that are starting to come along. Shouldn't we see what we can do with this? Now, I couldn't have asked for a better team to start this. And Gary Thomas, he's published over 80 papers on this as lead author, the co-I of the AIM mission. He's so well-respected in the field that we commonly refer to terms of noctilucent cloud albedo in terms of Gary's. My Dave Fritz, I've heard him once referred to as a national resource, a national treasure. So what he does is really unique in capability to bring together experimental data and build mathematical analytical models. His expertise there. So really had a great proposal. I think that's what NASA really liked about the background, the people, and fortunately they saw the value in this, even though it was principally a science program, and we came through a program that has generally supported technologies through flight opportunities. So it were technologies that directly enabled science. So that really was the genesis, and we talked about before, from that initial proposal, we really started to realize, how can we improve these models? How can we build upon this to really create a suborbital laboratory that will give us the most improved models of this region of the atmosphere?
So all of this came out of your dissertation?
No, certainly I wouldn't go that far. I was thinking of this as an extension of this. Now, Gary and Dave have been doing this for a very, very long time, and Dave has over 200 publications on this. So I think I contributed a little bit of operational insights and some instrumentation insight into the program, and maybe just had a desire to really run with it.
So it's interesting that you get to create and work in the field directly related to your dissertation, and you get to sort of start the business. So I find that pretty amazing. That doesn't happen very often.
It's very interesting, the synthesis. Now, Gary and Dave are true scientists. I found going into this, my role has been more one of trying to herd the cats and to be just knowledgeable enough in the science and in engineering and the public outreach and education aspects, as well as business aspects. And so it seemed to be a number of different things to actually growing the program and letting it do what it's designed to do, basically enable science, do education and outreach efforts.
When you finally get this going, it's going to be an interesting celebration of completion for you. So are you planning to do a mission?
Well, we're not really releasing any flight manifests at the time. Certainly, passion has always been in science and engineering and operations, but we don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole until we really see vehicles that are tested and operating.
Well, hopefully that'll start to happen pretty quickly. it seems like the industry is moving forward. So you may not have to wait much longer.
It's an exciting time to be in this, indeed.
So if the if X-Corp called you and said, hypothetically, we're ready to go by April 2016, would you be ready to go by April 2016?
The only thing that would hold us, we're in the process right now of licensing for a suitable facility and the logistics. But our instrumentation is certainly been tested. There's certainly going to be some tests, but I think if that was the time frame, that our instruments and our flight crew would be able to step up to that.
So you think you could do it? I mean, that's a pretty close-in date, and it's not in the right season, but just hypothetically.
We would definitely be rushed to go through a number of tests with the instruments, so I will only speak for those two elements right now. However, assuming that the licensing typically takes about 12 months to do, so that would be probably the thing that would
hold you
make that specific date not available to us. But we are still targeting for the 2017, which is much more realistic on our side.
Interesting. So where in Alaska would you launch from? Are you talking about Kodiak, or you mentioned spaceports? Are you thinking of coming up with your own location?
No, we're looking at the Fairbanks region, and we're in the discussion at the moment with this.
So you'd have a spaceport in and around Fairbanks, hopefully?
Not necessarily a spaceport, but the permissions.
Love to have if you have a big celebration at your launch, invite the media. I'd love to come.
We would love to have you. Again, I don't want to elaborate too much more on things until they're more mature.
Obviously. So are you getting pretty good feedback and interest from the general public, and is your outreach working?
Very much so. In fact, this year has really been an explosion. You know, not just in media from globally. We've had a contest, for example, with Fox Exploration Outer Space that's been active. We'll be representing in this program. There's some efforts in Canada. Contest. It's really the message of the program is really starting to resonate with people. So it's exciting.
Absolutely. Now, at Emory-Riddle, do you draw from just their student base in the region, or are you now able to draw from around the country? Are you getting that kind of out-of-the-box publicity that takes you to all points around the country and all different kinds of schools?
Well, it's actually more global even than that.
More global, okay.
We have some major universities that are partners. Certainly Emory-Riddle plays a very pivotal role in our education and our crew element to this. Been a wonderful partner. We've also been working closely with Columbia University, GATS here in Boulder, University of Colorado, together with LASP, Utah State University. We've been working with Clemson University as well, and even in Germany with the IAP. I never get that acronym right. And so it's and GATS, of course, is our modeling partner, but we have a number of different sponsors. A lot of these are listed on our press kit, and it's downloadable on our website, dealing with the this event coming up with what we call Class 1502 and 1503, as well as Possum Academy. There's a lot more about some of the key players and the members, the instructors of the program, as well as our sponsors and our partner organizations as well.
On your website?
Yes.
And that's...
widget on the left, and you can also go to the press, and there's a downloadable press kit there as well. And this has bios of all the members, and they're... national origin and a little bit about their backgrounds, people that will be attending and participating in these October programs.
Do you get any kind of grades or continuing education credit for your academy and your astronaut program?
Yes, I do. Three credits from Embry-Riddle on both programs. Well, so not only do they get a graduation certificate from our own program, but they get three continuing education credits from Embry-Riddle and a certificate that honors that as well.
Okay, well, that's pretty cool. So now Embry-Riddle has other campuses, so I'm imagining it's the same, right?
Yes, we administer this in Daytona Beach, and there's a number of reasons that it's an ideal location. One of the real benefits is, even though that we're a Ronami program focused on a particular mission, there's some really exciting spin-offs that come from this. So while we do these programs, we actually are able to mature technologies, not just mature technologies for the science, but other spin-off technologies that can do many different applications of imagery and remote sensing. Not just that, but the spacesuits, with our partners at Final Frontier, we're able to, as our participants and our students go through these programs, we work with them to mature the designs of the spacesuit. One case in point, in this class, not only will we get a lot of data through many simulated flights, but we're working to do the first commercial zero-gravity, microgravity research program. And we're going to have a series of flights, microgravity flights, together with Integrated Space Flight that's designed the research manifest, the number of POSSUM graduates and participants. And we're going to really try to mature, work with Final Frontier to give them some good real data points that can help them meet certain requirements of their partnership with NASA and other things that could help them with designs. So there's this is going to go on in mid-October as well. And so it's a number of really exciting spin-off research and spin-off technologies that just organically grow from the core mission of POSSUM.
I would say so. So there's a thing on your website that says mission supplies. So what are mission supplies? Do you have to furnish different things to take the courses?
No, there's some POSSUM swag, as we call it, mission shirts and
okay, so
patches. But most significantly, there's the POSSUM manual, and this is a 260-page text, and it covers a lot of what we do in the program, everything from mesospheric science to the concept of spaceflight operations, spacesuit operations, and it really gets into the nitty-gritty of working on space imagery systems, goes into operating and flying the POSSUM sim, goes into the concepts behind the models and what we do with the science, and communicating the science, education and public outreach as well. So it's a manual that touches on a wide variety. You can order it online. Of course, it's given to all of our students that go through the program. And
so that's like the textbook for everything you do.
Yes, it covers, and there's a lot of contributors to that. So I just represent myself as editor, but it's a product of a number of people that have really made a very good name for themselves. Some core contributors like, besides Final Frontier, core contributors like Dr. Eric Seedhouse, aerospace physiology. I know you've had him on the show a couple times, as well as people that have been very involved with the development of the simulator.
I knew Eric was involved with a company in Florida, but I didn't know it was your company.
Well, he's a professor now at the Embry-Riddle.
Okay.
So he
furnished several of the books that we did as fundraisers for our crowdfunding program. He's a prolific author, as you know.
Indeed.
Very prolific author. So I did not know he was faculty at Embry-Riddle yet. So that's at the Daytona Beach campus, right?
Yes.
Good for Eric.
And in fact, he's now the manager of the Possum Simulator at Embry-Riddle, a suborbital spaceflight simulator.
Good for Eric.
Indeed.
So has he left Canada? He's now down in Florida?
He's residing principally in Daytona now.
Well, another good for him. He's coming on the show soon, so we'll be looking forward to that update with him. He's a good, credible guy, so you have a good team member there.
Indeed, and he's just found a home close to many, many bike trails.
To many, many what?
Bike trails.
Oh, bike trails. Yeah, he's kind of a super athlete nerd. You know, he's triathlon kind of guy, so that doesn't surprise me. He can outbike the alligators, I'm sure. What do you see as your biggest challenge going forward?
It's hard to even start with there. This has been a labor of love. It's been a number of years of a lot of work that's just now bringing the parts together. We didn't have major financial background. We were just a lot of people that came together with a story and a passion to this. Everything that had started with the program was really done pro bono. People like I mentioned Sundog and Embry-Riddle and Vasco's group, OMW Manufacturing built the prototype Possum Cam design as well, and that's our partners at Cinema Raven as well. Fantastic group here in Boulder that does it's really been getting us some fantastic imagery. Some of the pictures on our website and some of the outreach to potential sponsors has been led by them, and indeed maturation and the imagery capability of Possum Can itself. So a lot of people that believe in the science and the mission, just now it's been growing and catching on, but it would never have been possible without people that have really become vested in what the program represented and were able to support the program through in-kind contributions of their supplies and expertise.
Gina, we don't get very many Ginas, is Las Vegas, Nevada. And Gina says, I'm high school, and I would love to do this, but I haven't had any of the math that you're talking about. So would I be disqualified from either program? I was a social science major.
The Possum Academy is very conceptual. It's hard to avoid some trigonometry just because of how the mission is designed, understanding the scattering angles and why we launch the way we do and when we launch. We try to capture that as basically as practically as possible, just by getting some concepts of how the sun moves, how the clouds reflect light, and how the vehicle moves.
Well, do they have to work problems, or do they just have to conceptually understand it?
We do have some problems. Most are very conceptual. Possum Academy, some take some light math. But these are certainly things we work through. Certainly if you can go through private pilot course and do some of the questions that the FAA requires, is certainly the kind of background that would be adequate for the Possum Academy.
Be prepared to do a lot of 11th hour tutoring or being tutored, right?
Certainly. And we add a day at the end of each program. This day is there in case there's weather delays for the flight component of the program, but also there to give students one-on-one attention for any academic material that isn't necessarily clear. But we go through a program. We have a series of webinars to prepare to answer questions leading up to the program. In fact, our first ones are here this Thursday, and we have two each day because we have people all over the globe. So we try to at least give one time that people can tie in. It's not in the middle of the night. And so from those webinars, then we focus directly on on a review and practice problems that are most germane to the mission and everything during the course. And we leave a little bit of time in that weather day to address individual concerns as well.
So they're not going to flunk, so to speak.
No, the academy. we're pretty sure that we can train anyone to do the science. You know, we screen people for some big red flags as well and make them aware. You know, certainly if you're very claustrophobic or something in space, it's probably not a good environment. So it's a good idea to get in that idea. But what we really focus on is understanding the concepts behind the mission and the science, and you know, try to use some multi-ability to really be able to read and stay current in things and you know, stay with the program and be a part of the program. And whether it's, you know, going through the Centive Astronaut Program and looking at support and sponsorships for their own flights with our support, you know, for it's just something that you want to really immerse yourself into this kind of program where, you know, the skills can augment and complement other things you do in your professional and personal life.
I am claustrophobic, and I'm okay in a spacesuit until they close the visor on the helmet.
We recommend people have a little bit of scuba experience. It's not a hard requirement, but if they're okay in scuba, I'll usually find they're going to be okay in a spacesuit.
I am a scuba diver, so that is of no problem for me whatsoever. But once they close the faceplate on the helmet, that just about did me in. And the other one that does me in all the time is going into an MRI machine.
You know, these suits are fantastic. You know, it's you know, our designer has worked in with these in Moscow for 25 years. Your final frontier.
Yeah, they've been on. Ted has been on the space show a couple of times.
Yeah.
He's a great guy.
So if you've been in a suit, it's
I haven't been
amazing
in his suit.
Engineering piece, and yeah. We have our own suits. They're designing and they're building our own Possum suits right now. We'll break the first one will be available in October, and the second one will be available for the May course. So it's great getting to work together with them and have a custom suit supporting Project Possum.
We are at the end of the program. What should we have talked about that I've forgotten to bring up, or that you want to make sure that the listeners know about, or do you have a takeaway for us?
Oh, wow. I feel like I've been talking. I don't know if I've addressed any questions, but you know, I just invite everyone to either reach out to the program at info@projectpossum.org or me personally at jason.reimuller at projectpossum.org. You know, we have several things on the forefront, and certainly invite anyone to look at our programs or text, or if you're an educator and are interested in actually, you know, the Possum Academy coming to your school as early as next summer. That's certainly an option, or if you're a researcher and looking at manifesting or want to see your research represented in the Possum program. Any of these, you know, this is your all program, and we do our best to represent both the research community, but also the education community, so that we no longer have an ignorosphere.
All right. Well, please do keep me posted on your progress, and we'll be happy to talk to you and do some more updates as you get closer and closer to doing things. And it sounds like a lot of fun. I wish I were down there in Florida. I'd do one of the courses.
We would love to have you, David. I thank you so much for having me tonight. Represent Project Possum.
Yeah, I'd have to do the one with the least amount of math, but I'd get through it.
Well, I'm sure you would quite well.
Thank you very much, Jason, and I look forward to talking to you again when you see Eric. Give him our regards, okay?
Absolutely, will do.
Thank you very much. And listeners, that's it. And Bill Harwood, speaking of Florida, is Hotel Mars tomorrow night with some updates on what's going on the ISS and a couple of other things. And then Rand Simberg is back on Friday, and Dr. Doug Plata is back on Sunday. Thank you all for listening to tonight's space show. And again, thank you for your support on our Indiegogo crowdfunding program. It ends in a couple more hours, so check it out if you haven't been there yet. Thank you, Jason. Good night, and best of luck to everybody. Keep looking up. Goodbye from the space show.